Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the budget deal that keeps the lights on and avoids a government shutdown and a debt ceiling crisis through the election year. And while it is really a gift to the Republicans in terms of avoiding political suicide, it is nevertheless seen as a betrayal by the Tea Party Freedom Caucus. Jared Bernstein, a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, who was the chief economist and chief economic advisor to Vice President Joe Biden, joins us to discuss the deal that John Boehner refers to as cleaning out the barn, which, in an orchestrated attempt to assuage the fractious Freedom Caucus, his successor Paul Ryan is disdaining. Then we'll look into the World Health Organization's report that warns processed meat causes cancer and red meat is likely to be carcinogenic too. Marion Nestle, who was a senior nutrition advisor in the Department of Health and Human Services and a member of the American Cancer Society's committee that issues dietary guidelines for cancer prevention, joins us to discuss how we should avoid bacon, sausages, ham, jerky, and hot dogs and cut back on red meats such as steak, lamb, and pork and start treating meat as a condiment to be served with vegetables and grain. Then finally, we'll examine the latest in what are considered war crimes committed against Médecins Sans Frontières with the bombing of an MSF hospital in Yemen following the recent bombing of an MSF hospital in Kunduz, Afghanistan. An expert on Yemen, Dr. Sheila Carapico, the author of Civil Society in Yemen, The Political Economy of Activism in Modern Arabia, joins us to discuss the Saudi-led bombing campaign in Yemen that has previously targeted museums and cultural heritage sites in the poorest Arab country that is undergoing a Saudi blockade, which the UN warns is causing a humanitarian catastrophe. Joining us now is Jared Bernstein, who is a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. From 2009 to 2011, he was the chief economist and economic advisor to Vice President Joe Biden, executive director of the White House Task Force on the Middle Class, and a member of President Obama's economic team. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jared Bernstein.
Thank you for inviting me.
And the budget deal that was worked out last night, do you think, let's talk about it in political terms first, does it get the Republicans off the hook from their suicidal tendencies to want to shut down the government and raise the debt limit? Or not raise the debt limit?
I think it probably does. If this deal is going to pass, remember it hasn't been voted on yet, but if this deal is going to pass, mostly with the votes of Democrats in the House. And the leader of the Democratic caucus, Nancy Pelosi, has already pledged that her members will come to the floor and support this bill. That means that you need a relatively small number of Republicans to get it over the hurdle. So even if the obstructionists try to block it, they may not prevail.
Well, also, politically speaking, it does look as if Paul Ryan is doing the expedient thing to say this is a terrible deal to satisfy the Freedom Caucus or the Tea Party Caucus. At the same time, in effect, John Boehner is taking the fall here, and he's out the door in any case. And he did say this is all about cleaning out the barn.
Right. Well, Ryan's performance here is true kabuki dancing. Speaker Boehner is doing Ryan a huge favor. Now, just to give you the background, Paul Ryan is probably going to take over as Speaker of the House, and he wants to appeal to the hard right, which probably really dislikes this sort of a deal, almost certainly. So he has to make it sound like he hates it, he can't stand it, and put it all on, as you said, Speaker Boehner, who's perfectly happy to pass this deal with mostly Democrats, clean out the barn, as it were, get these legislative kind of congressional food fights off of the docket for a few years. And in fact, that's one of the good things about this plan is that if this plan passes, and again, I think it probably will, we shouldn't be looking at fiscal cliffs and debt ceilings and shutdowns again until 2017.
Right, but that does raise the question of, you know, I understand the logic here that there has to be an adult in the room here, in that the Democrats are stepping up to the plate as adults to stop these persistent threats to shut down the government. And, of course, failing to raise the debt ceiling, we're unique in the world in as much as we spend money first and pay for it later. And we know what the consequences are of failing to raise the debt ceiling. They'd be devastating for the U.S. economy and for the value and the fact that the U.S. dollar is a global reserve currency. So it would be a massively self-inflicted wound. But just to stay on the politics for a minute, it does feel like the Democrats are taking away what might be a great opportunity to get back the House. Is these guys, if they're determined to go on this suicide mission, at some point or other, the American people are going to wake up and just say, enough already.
You know, I think that's a potential scenario, but for a while now, it's really been, as you suggested, the grown-ups in the room kind of saving the vehicle before we crater headlong over the cliff. Now, one might strategically want to play that differently, as you suggest, but that's just not the way they've played it. I mean, I myself have strongly advocated against breaching the debt ceiling for all the reasons you mentioned. The idea of that kind of a kamikaze action against our gold-plated credit rating strikes me as economic suicide. So I can't imagine somehow using that as a political cudgel. But look, you may be onto something.
And again, I'm speaking with Jared Bernstein, who is a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities from 2009 to 2011. He was the chief economist and economic advisor to Vice President Joe Biden, executive director of the White House Task Force on the Middle Class, and a member of President Obama's economic team. So turning to the budget deal itself, it does look as though the idea, I guess what's happening here is that Obama has stood his ground against this blunt instrument known as the sequester. And he's pretty much chipping away at it. I mean, it's still around, but how would you rate its life expectancy, the sequester?
Well, it's an interesting question. We have these sequestered budget caps. And in fact, they really haven't fully kicked in since they've been introduced, I don't think. Now, we've cut spending quite significantly, so don't get me wrong. But a few years ago, for 2014 and 15, Senator Patty Murray and Congressman Paul Ryan provided some sequestration relief. And now we have this next round, which actually goes quite a bit deeper. If you look at the numbers in this budget proposal, they eliminate about 90% of the sequestered budget cuts for the non-defense side of the budget, which is particularly important because that's where a lot of the investment that we really need and we've been lacking, whether it's in education or in some healthcare research, education and training, those kinds of expenditures, very important. And as I mentioned, this deal replaces 90% of the sequestered budget cuts for 2016 and about 60% for 2017. So, and it's not just President Obama, by the way, because Republicans have also chafed at the bit of sequestration, probably more on the defense side of the budget, and they got some resources for that in this deal as well.
Well, they got $32 billion in this overseas contingency fund, right, which is often referred to as a slush fund. And I'm wondering why it is that President Obama, who vetoed recently the National Defense Authorization Act, on the basis that it was full of budget gimmicks, in particular this slush fund, and now he's sort of accepted it. So what's going on there?
Well, I think there are just a lot of lawmakers on Capitol Hill who hear about defense appropriations, and that's all they need to know to support them. I think that we have a lot of work to do to actually figure out the extent to which these expenditures are needed or not. I think it's probably wrong to have a knee-jerk response that assumes any defense spending is wasteful, but it's just as wrong to get behind any increase as absolutely necessary, and I think the president's veto was a thoughtful one. However, to get a budget bill like this one, this sequestration relief, there, in the spirit of compromise, there had to be parity between the defense and the non-defense side, or I suspect the vote would never have gotten this far.
So in terms of the good, the bad, and the ugly, what then did the Democrats have to swallow in terms of, we mentioned defense.
We mentioned defense, but other than defense, there's actually not a lot. And that's one of the things that's, I think, important and interesting about the deal that it's not a surprise to me to hear Nancy Pelosi saying she thinks this is a very strong deal. One feature is that in order to raise about $8 billion to pay for the deal, they're repealing a health reform component, one that's not been implemented yet, but it's part of the Affordable Care Act that has an automatic enrollment policy for employees who work in large firms. And the idea was to increase enrollment in employer-based plans. But that's never been implemented. And in fact, the implementation turned out to be very tricky. So that repeal was part of this deal. One thing now, kind of curiously, that you might hear, though, is a lot of Republicans going around saying, we've repealed Obamacare, because, of course, they've been targeting that for a long time. And that's not at all the case. It's just this one piece that has yet to be implemented.
But how much of these demonstration projects that the Republicans are insisting on, which are a sort of pretty much a stalking horse for ways to cut programs that they don't like more cuts in food stamps, and they're particularly going after the Social Security Disability Insurance Program, how much are they the nose of the camel?
The budget deal includes some savings from the disability insurance program. It ends a 16-year-old pilot program that's been in place in about 20 states having to do with disability determinations. And, I mean, I think you're right to worry about a stalking horse there. But at the same time, remember, the deal restores a potential 20% cut, a huge cut in the payments for Social Security disability, and it increases the solvency of the program through 2022 by transferring funds from one part of Social Security that has more than it needs to the disability part that has less than it needs. And that's actually a great way to sustain the program. So on net, Social Security disability insurance actually did well in this deal.
And what about food stamps?
There's nothing in the bill on food stamps, so that didn't come up.
So the demonstration projects were a kind of a consolation prize because the Republicans failed to get bigger cuts in food stamps in the farm bill last year. So that's my understanding.
Yeah, I mean, you're right that they're gunning for food stamps, but at least in this bill, is my understanding, the food stamps isn't in play.
So in terms of the politics, back to the politics, obviously, we mentioned that Paul Ryan is sort of being the good cop, where Boehner is being the bad cop as far
as... Well, depending on how you define good and bad, but yeah.
Right. But, well, I was going to say, as far as the Freedom Caucus is concerned,
right.
He's basically saying, look, I hate this thing, but and it's this guy that's on his way out the door that's done it. But once Ryan has lost Boehner, who in effect is his protection against the Freedom Caucus, how much do you think he's going to be on his own and and under withering fire like his predecessor?
He may be missing his good friend Johnny.
Right.
Most people will tell you that, just looking at it from the outside, the Freedom Caucus and thus the Congressional Republican Caucus in the House is ungovernable. It's not clear that Paul Ryan has any secret sauce that John Boehner didn't have. So it wasn't a surprise to anyone any of us who followed this, that Paul Ryan was very hesitant to take this job because it kind of, thus far anyway, has had failure built into it, and he doesn't want that. So we'll see what the future holds. I mean, if he is somehow able to herd cats on the Republican side of the House, that will be a remarkable achievement. I would say probably the odds are against that.
So he's probably going to vote against it, right, Paul Ryan?
I suspect he will.
To look good to the Freedom Caucus, because they'll vote against it, and the Democrats will vote for it. And how many Republicans do they need?
I mean, 40 or 50, I think.
And Boehner can deliver them?
He believes he can, yeah.
Well, but won't those people be up for primary threats next year, if not
now?
Well,
not every district is fraught with kind of Tea Party kind of obstructionist types. So there is a there remains a moderate group in the Republican House. You just don't hear about them very much. Partly they keep a low profile, but they just don't make the kind of fireworks that the hard right does.
So the two real contentious issues, that, particularly with the Freedom Caucus, were not addressed in this prospective deal that just was negotiated last night. And I guess, is it being voted on now, I think? But the two issues are the Highway Trust Fund and the reauthorization of the Export-Import Bank. That seems to be something of a litmus test, the Import-Export Bank, for the Tea Party Caucus, the Freedom Caucus.
Right, but there's drama going on with that as well. There's nothing happening with the Highway Trust Fund, and that is going to have to be resolved. But on the Export-Import Bank, the Congress did something, this very rarely used move called the discharge petition, where a significant majority of members of the House have some procedure. I can't say I fully understand it myself, but it's a vote that basically allows them to dynamite a provision out of a committee where it's stuck. And it's almost never used because it's considered an extremely partisan thing. And the Democrats voted along with a number of Republicans to discharge the bill on the Export-Import Bank from the committee where it was just essentially being left for dead. Once it gets out of the committee, it will probably pass. And so you've got a kind of a little bit of an open revolt there among Republicans who support the EXIM Bank.
Well, my understanding that there was it didn't get a lot of publicity, but it was certainly, it could have been a major deal breaker for the economy and for the country. And that was that apparently a deal was made some time back after the train accident in Philadelphia, where it was decided that you need this positive control mechanism, this automatic mechanism on trains, that if the operator falls asleep or whatever, they will automatically put the brakes on and thus prevent some of these terrible accidents that have happened, and that they gave a deadline for doing that, and they're going to miss the deadline and therefore shut down, in effect, the entire rail system. There was some concern about that. Is that being alleviated?
I don't know where that is, but I'm familiar with the situation, and what little I've heard suggests that it is being worked on to avoid that kind of a shutdown, which would be a pretty serious problem in terms of a main artery within our economy in terms of moving freight.
Well, that, just in closing, Jared Bernstein, gets me to the broader question about, and maybe it's just futile talking about how things should be and how they used to be, but we are at a time where you still have all-time low interest rates, a quarter of 1%. This is a perfect time, a propitious time, to address America's crumbling infrastructure. We just mentioned the issues with the trains, but roads and bridges are falling apart, etc. Is there any way that there can be some kind of appeal to logic and even patriotism here? That, look, you know, let's just bite the bullet now while we can and bring us back up to where the rest of the advanced democracies are in terms of their infrastructure, particularly China, that's just making us look really bad in terms of their extraordinary infrastructure that they're investing in. And by the way, you put a lot of people back to work and generate a lot of money into the economy.
It is commonsensical. It is logical. It's exactly what you would like to see us do, especially, as you mentioned, with the cost of borrowing so low. It's just very much a win-win kind of idea. And unfortunately, I have to report, I was recently up talking to a number of senators about this very point, and the sense I got was that it's extremely unlikely that that Congress would vote for that. I mean, as you mentioned a minute ago, even a really procedural measure just to make sure we have our highways adequately funded, even that used to be kind of just not a partisan thing, but just akin to keeping the lights on. But even that now is a big, fractious, last-minute kind of debate. I think if you have to understand what's at the heart of this dysfunction. There are we don't have a parliamentary system where things can unfold in a more orderly way, and some sort of rump group can sit on the sidelines and throw spitballs. The way our system works is when it comes to measures like infrastructure investment, a group of 40 or 50 or 60 obstructionists can block everything. And that's what they've done. This is a systemic problem. We have members of Congress who essentially believe they were sent there to stop pretty much everything from happening, even things that we obviously need and things that historically haven't been a reach or a heavy lift at all. So this is a political problem, and talking rational economics about it really won't help you understand it.
Well, Jared Bernstein, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Jared Bernstein. He's a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities from 2009 to 2011. He was the chief economist and economic advisor to Vice President Joe Biden, executive director of the White House Task Force on the Middle Class, and a member of President Obama's economic team. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the World Health Organization's warning that processed meat causes cancer and red meat is likely to be carcinogenic too. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Marion Nestle, who's the Paulette Goddard Professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health, and Professor of Sociology at New York University. She was a Senior Nutrition Policy Advisor in the Department of Health and Human Services and has been a member of the FDA Food Advisory Committee and Service Board and the USDA DHHS Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee and the American Cancer Society Committee's that issue dietary guidelines for cancer prevention. She's also the author of Eat, Drink, Vote, an illustrated guide to food politics, how the food industry influenced nutrition and health. And her latest book is Soda Politics, Taking on Big Soda and Winning. Welcome to Background Briefing, Marion Nestle.
Glad to be here.
And the World Health Organization have just announced that processed meat does cause cancer and red meat is probably carcinogenic too. This has got to be a bit of a shock to both the American public, that particularly those who eat bacon, sausage, hot dogs, salami, corned beef, beef jerky and ham, as well as canned meat. And I imagine it's not very welcome with the Cattlemen's Association.
No, it wouldn't be, would it? I don't know why anybody would be surprised. This information has been around since the 1970s, when it was quite clear that something about the processing of meat and red meats in general increased the presence of carcinogens. Nobody's really sure how any of that works, but they seem to be there and raise the risk of cancer, particularly cancer, colorectal cancer. That's the one that seems to be most at issue here. So what the WHO committee didn't do was to talk about the levels of meat that were responsible for doing this. If you eat meat every day, that raises the risk. How much does it raise the risk? And if you're only eating meat once in a while, does that reduce the risk? And if so, by how much? Those kinds of news you can use, kinds of information, aren't really available. What seems to be clear is that people who regularly consume processed meats, and that means smoked, cured, salted, et cetera, bacon, sausage, hot dogs, and so forth, tend to have higher rates of colorectal cancer than those who don't. And that people who eat red meat tend to have higher rates of colorectal cancer than those who don't. But if you eat meat once in a while, is that going to cause you problems? Hard to know.
Well, according to the World Cancer Research Fund, they recommend as little as possible processed meat and 500 grams of cooked red meat. And, of course, an 8-ounce steak is about 225 grams. So that's basically two steaks per week. Does that seem reasonable to you?
If they have evidence, and that was the previous major cancer report that came out with this kind of information, and that recommendation is it's more steak than I eat, but it's probably less than an awful lot of other people. 500 grams is a little bit more than a pound.
Mm-hmm. So my understanding, though, is that the carcinogenic chemicals that form during meat processing include N-nitroso compounds and polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons.
Yes, those are nasty.
Right, but aren't they also the result of high temperatures from barbecuing? They also produce polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons.
Well, that's cooked meat.
Right. But does the barbecuing process...
So if you cook at high temperature, you produce these things. I mean, the real question is what happens to those compounds in the body. Those are clearly carcinogenic compounds. But the human body has several kinds of detoxification systems. The problem is you don't know how they work. And in this particular case, there's ample evidence that people who eat more meat and more processed meat have higher rates of colorectal cancer than those who don't. And there's always been evidence that people who are vegetarian and don't eat red meat at all have much less cancer and heart disease and other diseases than people who consume other kinds of diets. So we've known this for a very long time.
And again, I'm speaking with Marion Nestle, who is the Paulette Goddard Professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies and Public Health and Professor of Sociology at New York University. She was Senior Nutrition Policy Advisor in the Department of Health and Human Services and has been a member of the FDA Food Advisory Committee and Science Board and the USDA DHHS Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee and the American Cancer Society committees that issue dietary guidelines for cancer prevention. She's also the author of Eat, Drink, Vote, an illustrated guide to food politics, how the food industry influences nutrition and health. And her latest book is Soda Politics, Taking on Big Soda and Winning. So the fact that this information has been around since the 1970s would either indicate, one, people are willfully ignoring it, or two, that those who have a stake in it, in other words, the Cattlemen's Association and et cetera, don't want this information publicized. Is that why it has sort of gone under the radar for so long?
Well, that would be part of it, but you know, meat consumption is way down. Beef consumption in particular has been dropping for years, while chicken consumption, which is much less of a problem, is going up. So I think the message is getting out that red meats are not healthy, and if they're not, if the message isn't as specific as this one is, people have gotten the idea they're not eating as much of it. This is where the end winning comes in.
I see. So what does it say about the USDA? Who in our country should be carrying the ball?
On advising about less meat?
Right, right.
We have dietary guidelines for Americans that are going to come out this year. And the committee that wrote the report on which the guidelines are based certainly advised cutting down on processed and red meats. They tried to emphasize the importance of cutting down on red meats by throwing in the additional factor that if we ate less beef, we would have less of an agricultural impact on climate change. But the agencies have said they're not allowed to talk about climate change in the dietary guidelines. So I guess they'll be sticking to just talking about the health effects, but they do talk about the carcinogenic potential of processed meat and red meat. Whether the agencies will include that in the dietary guidelines, we don't know yet.
So that is a congressional mandate over the USDA. the Department of Agriculture, right?
The congressional mandate is for the Department of Agriculture and Health and Human Services to issue dietary guidelines every 5 years.
Right, but they've added to that saying, don't mention climate change.
Well, Congress, the House of Representatives, has issued a rider to an appropriations bill saying that the Department of Agriculture should not allow that to happen. But the Secretaries of Agriculture and Health and Human Services have both announced publicly to Congress that sustainability and issues of agricultural ecology would not be in the dietary guidelines.
So they've caved. The executive branch has caved to the climate deniers, climate change deniers, and anti-science
people. Well, I think they caved to the meat industry.
But why cave, though, to the climate deniers and the anti-science bloc in the Congress?
They claim that they don't have statutory authority to talk about environmental issues in the dietary guidelines.
I see. So who's going to speak up in favor of science, facts, and health?
Consumers, I hope.
Uh-huh. But surely, you know, the fact that this World Health Organization study's gotten some attention is encouraging, but somebody else has got to carry the ball, it would seem to me.
Well, yes. And then the question is how does this get implemented into policy? It would have been very helpful, I think, if the WHO committee had spent a little time talking about what it meant in practice, but they didn't. So they've left it up to everybody else to take the information and to figure out what to do with it.
But the climate connection, and there was a study done at Chatham House that in London that makes it pretty clear that there is a direct connection, and that as the population of the Earth continues to grow, it's simply unsustainable to have a diet of animal protein, even in small amounts, because one of the paradoxes is that as countries, as their standard of living improves, like, for example, in China and India, their consumption...
The first thing they want is more meat.
Right. That seems to be the kind of, you know, badge of that you've finally made it in the world.
People like eating meat. They like the way it tastes. They like the idea of getting protein in that concentrated form. And they want to be able to eat it, and that would be fine if we didn't eat so much and if everybody didn't aspire to our level of hamburgers and hot dogs.
So do you have any statistics on that, how much meat we eat compared to the rest of the advanced...
I don't remember the numbers offhand, but we consume much more.
I see. So that's consistent with our global warming footprint as well, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
So
yes, and there's no question that beef raising increases greenhouse gases much more than raising of any other agricultural commodity.
And that's to do with what?
With the growing feed, mostly.
And what's the issue with methane?
Well, and then methane from cows' digestive tracts.
Right. And is there any way to do anything about that? I mean, it seems...
I don't think so. Have fewer cows.
Right.
Would be the best way.
Right. So in general, then, what's our takeaway here, Marion Nestle, for our audience? I mean, obviously...
The takeaway is to eat meat less often, and in smaller amounts. Use it as a condiment. Does it mean never eating meat? No, it doesn't, because it's a question of raising risk. And if you have a 15 to 30% risk and you've only got one case, a lot of this is statistical. But if you want to keep your risk for colorectal cancer and some other cancers low, you don't eat very much meat. And again, the evidence on vegetarian diets has made this very clear for a very long period of time.
So I guess...
That vegetarians are healthier.
Right. So then just to overcome the problem that you pointed out, that the problem is that people like meat and they like the taste of it. Is there any way that they can be encouraged to find vegetables more tasty?
They can, but... Or they can use meat in different ways. and in smaller ways. That's really not that hard to do.
I see.
I mean, certainly Asian diets and Mediterranean diets use very small amounts of meats, almost as condiments, so that you could get the taste and flavor without dealing with a very large steak or a slab. And if the recommendations are to have less than a pound a week, that still leaves you a pound.
Well, yes. I think you've made a good case that we are given to excess, shall we say.
Well, we're Americans. That's what we do.
Well, all righty. Well, on that note, on that patriotic note, I thank you very much for joining us.
All right. Pleasure to be here.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Marion Nestle, who is the Paulette Goddard Professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health, and Professor of Sociology at New York University. She was Senior Nutrition Policy Advisor in the Department of Health and Human Services and has been a member of the FDA Food Advisory Committee and Science Board and the USDA DHHS Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee and the American Cancer Society committees that issue dietary guidelines for cancer prevention. She's also the author of Eat, Drink, Vote, An Illustrated Guide to Food Politics, Food Politics, How the Food Industry Influences Nutrition and Health. And her latest book is Soda Politics, Taking on Big Soda and Winning. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into what is considered war crimes committed against Med Sans Frontiere with the bombing of an MSF hospital in Yemen. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Dr. Sheila Carapico, who's a professor of political science and international studies at the University of Richmond. Recently, she was a visiting professor in the political science department at the American University of Cairo and is the author of Civil Society in Yemen, The Political Economy of Activism in Modern Arabia. And her latest book is Political Aid and Arab Activism, Democracy Promotion, Justice and Representation. She's also a contributing editor to Middle East Report. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Sheila Carapico.
My pleasure.
And there has been another bombing of a Médecins Sans Frontières hospital, this time in North Yemen. Obviously, the bombing of the Kunduz hospital in Afghanistan captured world attention and prompted Médecins Sans Frontières to describe it as a war crime. They are also describing this bombing of this hospital in North Yemen as a war crime. Apparently, there was sustained bombing. The first bombs hit an unoccupied part of the hospital. They managed to evacuate everybody before the next series of bombs came in. So this is a bit peculiar, isn't it? According to the UNICEF, this hospital is the 39th health center that's been hit in Yemen since March.
Indeed. The Saudi-led coalition, they like to say, has been bombing indiscriminately. They have targeted, and in this case, there's no question that they targeted this particular hospital. In many of the other 39 cases that you named, it's also pretty clear that they were deliberately targeting the hospitals. This particular case, it's Saada Governorate, which is known as the homeland of the Houthi militias, who are ostensibly the targets of the Saudi-led bombing. And the Saudis have declared the entire governorate, that would be the equivalent of a state, so a very, very large area, they've declared the entire area to be a legitimate target. and their effort has been transparently and pretty much, you know, declared to be to depopulate the entire governorate. And part of that effort, obviously, is to drive out the one or two medical facilities that remain in the area to take care of both war wounded and, of course, people who just have not been able to leave. In large part, in many cases, the people who can't leave are people who are disabled or terribly ill to begin with. So I think the evidence of this specific one and many others being war crimes is, I think, rather clear.
But on top of this, the Saudis are conducting a blockade, which the United Nations has warned is a humanitarian catastrophe. And my understanding, it's creating malnutrition and starvation, particularly amongst children. So it feels as though this strategy of fighting the Houthis is really collective punishment.
Indeed. I mean, and the blockade has been going on for now 7 months, a naval blockade. They've also disabled most of the airports. The naval blockade, incidentally, is also supported by the United States, and the ostensible reason is to prevent Iranian shipments of arms, but it has also had the effect of preventing food, fuel, medicine, and other goods from entering Yemen. So in September, it was estimated that 1% of fuel needs imported fuel needs entered the country, 1% of what would be normal before the bombing campaign began in late March.
Well, of course, this is a case of the richest Arab country bombing the poorest Arab country.
Indeed. It's transparently a war of the oil dynasties against a very poor country, and also one, you know, with quite a, I mean, it's in dire straits now, but still has, you know, quite a lively history of pro-democracy movements, of socialists, of, you know, relative to the peninsula, of quite progressive politics.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Sheila Karapika, who's a professor of political science and international studies at the University of Richmond. Recently, she was a visiting professor in the political science department at the American University of Cairo and is the author of Civil Society in Yemen, The Political Economy of Activism in Modern Arabia. And her latest book is Political Aid and Arab Activism, Democracy Promotion, Justice and Representation. And she's also a contributing editor to Middle East Report. But some of the more frightening, as bad as this is, and by the way, previously I have we've discussed and I've spoken with other experts on Yemen about the Saudi bombing campaigns against World Heritage sites and cultural heritage sites in Yemen, including museums, where, according to The Economist, one of the last remaining fragments of an original Quran were destroyed. And most people attribute this insanity to the kind of Saudi Wahhabi religious ideology. Is there any other way to make any sense of it? I mean, it's bad enough to bomb hospitals, but in a so-called war environment, why are you bombing heritage sites?
They've bombed a number of heritage sites, some of them, you know, incredible archaeological places, like a place called Barakish. They've bombed historic mosques, museums, parts of the old city of Sana'a, which is a World Heritage Site, and other places. But, you know, this is also consistent with the Wahhabi disregard for history. I mean, so they've also bulldozed fairly notable historical and archaeological sites inside their own kingdom, and it's not surprising that in an effort to basically obliterate, you know, any kind of infrastructure or institutions in Yemen, that they would also have targeted historical sites. It's an incredible disregard for human life, first and foremost, for the ecology, and for history and culture and human dignity.
Well, it does seem that Saudi involvement, for example, in Syria has led to these sort of rabid Islamist sects like al-Nusra, al-Qaeda, and the self-declared Islamic State flourishing. There's no question that they've been armed, and now that the Russians have stepped in Syria, now apparently the arms are indiscriminately pouring in to these other Salafist groups. So there's already a pattern there, but now we're learning that in Aden, the port city of Yemen, which is apparently a very cosmopolitan city, at least it used to be, now these roaming bands of Islamist gunmen are running around, going into supermarkets and shooting up the ceilings and saying that the checkers have to cover up their faces. They're going to beaches where people are celebrating, having holidays, and they're rounding up people and making them put clothes on and turn off the music. It's an extraordinary case. And you were mentioning earlier that the country has had a tradition of political plurality and tolerance. How unusual is this that this is going on, where you have these masked Islamist gunmen basically running around trying to impose Sharia law?
Well, I mean, the situation in Aden, there are a number of sort of uniquely tragic situations, but there's a uniquely tragic situation in Aden, which was a British crown colony, formerly a very cosmopolitan port, and then had a socialist revolution and a socialist government for a number of years where women were, you know, very much part of the professions in law and medicine and communications and journalism and all kinds of areas, and where it was not at all common to see women veiled. And then quite more recently, the people in Aden definitely resisted the Houthis, who are the people that the Saudis are ostensibly targeting. And even though the Houthis were fighting against al-Qaeda, and now we're also seeing some elements of the so-called Islamic State in Aden, so the Saudis are targeting the enemies of al-Qaeda and the Islamic State. And they, quote-unquote, liberated Aden. In other words, they chased the Houthis out. And the Houthis, we say, but it's also the groups still affiliated with the deposed President Ali Abdullah Saleh. But in any case, you know, there was a little bit of celebration in Aden that it was liberated from the Houthis and the Saleh forces, only to find out within a matter of weeks that so-called liberation led quite quickly to, as you say, this influx of, you know, fanatical, Salafi, jihadist, misogynist, people, you know, just creating mayhem. I mean, so Aden is, the poor Adenis, it's really a dire situation there.
Well, Reuters are reporting that a lecturer at the University of Aden said five masked gunmen had stormed into his classrooms and demanded that male and female students be separated. And he quoted them as saying, "The time of debauchery and fornication is over. This is the time to abide by Islamic Sharia laws." So that's not that different from Wahhabism, is it, in Saudi Arabia? So is this like the Saudis have their Air Force bombing the place, and are they, in effect, opening the floodgates to these kind of Salafists to bring about the very strictures that exist in Saudi Arabia?
Well, yeah, ironically and again tragically, that appears to be what's going on, the scenario that's unfolding. I mean, in the interim, after Yemeni unity, and then there was a civil war in which the South wasn't happy with the unification and attempted to secede, and then they were basically overrun at the time with, maybe you wouldn't call them quite Salafi, but certainly with quite extreme Islamists, and, you know, who tried to get women to veil and, you know, to limit things like music and certainly to outlaw alcohol. They burned down, for example, there was a beer factory in Aden, and they burned it down. That was 1994. So it's not as if Aden has been some, you know, hotbed of debauchery since 1994. To the contrary, there's been, you know, a real influx of religious conservatives who were unquestionably backed by the Saudi kingdom. These more recent people, like this one you just described, we don't know if that's even a Yemeni, or if it's a Saudi, or if it's an Iraqi, or some Salafist from God only knows where. You know, I think we cannot, based on the evidence available, say uncategorically that the Saudis have been actually supporting the most radical Salafi jihadist elements who are now taking over Aden. But we can absolutely say that they have not been opposing them.
Well, what we can say, though, is, and if you, based upon what's happening in Iraq and what's happening in Syria, and now that the Russians have entered into Syria and are bombing on behalf of the Assads, the latest reports that I'm getting suggest that this offensive underway has not really done Assad much good, that as much as he's taken little bits of Aleppo, the Islamic State and al-Nusra and others have taken more of the key highway into Aleppo, which is a much more strategic asset. So that's a way to suggest that the bombing, no matter how intense, doesn't really change stuff on the ground that much. And we know that the U.S. and the coalition that President Obama often boasts has 60 members has been bombing the hell out of Iraq and Syria, trying to get rid of the Islamic State now for how many months? Almost 9 months, I think it's been. And no real evidence of any progress. So I'm assuming by that metric, the Saudis aren't really making any progress in Yemen as well against the Houthis. They're just punishing the unfortunate civilians.
Indeed. I mean, and, you know, in addition, I mean, as you rightly point out, the American bombing of Iraqi and Syrian positions has not worked. But the Saudis are far less experienced or professional in their targeting. The person in charge is this, you know, perhaps 30-year-old, untested son of the new king. So, I mean, it's really wanton. It's really indiscriminate, and it's kind of purposeless. And then the second thing I would say in response to kind of the spirit of your question is, you know, there's a real, we're starting to see more and more signs that the conflict in Yemen and the conflict that we call ISIS because it's in Iraq and Syria are starting to merge together. And the center point of that, of course, is Saudi Arabia, which is seems to think that they can just, you know, fund radicals and drop bombs and send arms and rely on American support, regardless of how irrational and poorly thought through their policies are.
Well, what is the U.S. Role, though? Because my understanding is that in the Arab world and in the Middle East, this is not referred to as a Saudi war against Yemen. This is referred to the U.S. and Saudi war.
Mm-hmm.
So we're supposedly coordinating with them in terms of targeting, and yet hospitals and are being bombed and World Heritage sites are being bombed. What's going on?
Well, I mean, the U.S. is providing surveillance. They provide in-flight refueling. I saw a report that it doesn't occur over Yemeni territory. In other words, they fly back into Saudi Arabia to refuel. We've, not only the U.S. definitely, but also the U.K., France, and even Canada, have fast-tracked new weapons sales to Saudi Arabia during this campaign, knowing that they're going to be used for an indiscriminate, cruel, and purposeless bombing of the poorest country in the region. The United States, again, is participating in the naval blockade. The United States, the Obama administration, welcomed King Salman, who there are rumors that he's a bit demented, to the White House during the midst of it. So the U.S. is, frankly, complicit in what look like multiple and egregious war crimes.
So, given how long this apparently futile war in Iraq has gone on against the Islamic State, and certainly how long the civil war in Syria has gone on, and now the Russians have joined in to prop up the almost extinguished Assad forces, reviving them, that's likely to protract this agony a lot longer. So I guess the prognosis for Yemen would be the same, right? So the U.S. is just participating in a long and pointless agony.
I think that's probably it in a nutshell, a long and pointless agony. There's a few gestures towards some kind of diplomacy, but they're very half-hearted. They're very kind of back burner. The chance of the Saudi Arabia and the Saudi-backed, ostensibly legitimate government of Abdurrabu Mansour Hadi accepting any terms of truce apart from just the complete and unconditional surrender of the other side are very remote. And I just add that I think that this ties back to your introduction. I think that the Saudis or probably some consultants that they've hired are studying things like the American bombing of the Médecins Sans Frontières hospital in Afghanistan, Israeli bombings, and claims that they've given fair warning and so forth. And I think the Saudis have learned how elastic the so-called rules of war are and how much impunity the aggressor has when they're using aircraft rather than, say, shoulder-held weapons. And I think they've learned the lesson and are pretty confident that they can bomb at will without facing. I mean, there was a Netherlands effort and some other efforts to, call into question the legality of the war, and it's basically been quashed by the UN Security Council and by the Obama administration and other NATO powers. So the chances of a diplomatic resolution or of the United Nations, the so-called international community, standing up to try to stop this war are very remote.
Well, Dr. Sheila Karapiko, I thank you very much for joining us.
Delightful. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Sheila Karapiko. She's a professor of political science and international studies at the University of Richmond. Recently, she was a visiting professor in the political science department at the American University of Cairo and is the author of Civil Society in Yemen, The Political Economy of Activism in Modern Arabia. And her latest book is Political Aid and Arab Activism, Democracy Promotion, Justice and Representation. She's also a contributing editor to Middle East Report. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcast at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Bye.